God, like a religious conference, is more than William Barber, by Professor Andrew McLean, who is an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Has a bachelor's degree from St. Olaf College, master's from City University of New York, and PhD from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, all in English. Interests in the 16th and 17th century, and is review editor of Clio magazine, which takes up a great deal of his time writing reviews. Anyhow, he will do the first paper, and then second I'll introduce Bill Johnson now, and then we'll just run right through the papers. William Johnson, who is an assistant professor at the University of Northern Illinois, who has a bachelor's degree from the University of Chicago and a master's and PhD from Iowa, University of Iowa, those in English, those degrees in English, and he will read a paper on Edmund Spencer and the Book of Common Prayer. We'll just read the two papers and then we'll have questions and commentary after. Thank you. I'd like to focus in the next 25 minutes, my time limit, on one dialogue by William Barlow and the major polemical dialogue with Thomas More, not in light of their theological position or the revelation of historic event, but rather to examine the literary art or lack of it with which More in particular enters into battle as a standard bearer of orthodoxy. When we examine More's dialogues as literary artifice, we witness the degeneration and eventual abandonment of the literary form initially used by More. This deterioration of literary form parallels More's realization, and that perhaps of the older humanists of his generation, that the younger humanists and the reformers in particular had sounded the death knell for reasoned discourse, and a shared concern for bonae literae, and the perfection of the Church Universal through reform. More replaces one form of persuasive eloquence embodied in the literary art of early polemical works for a different kind of rhetoric, the bluntness of his adversaries in his last polemical dialogue. The works I refer to include More's first venture into polemical dialogue, the dialogue concerning heresies, which was answered by William Tyndale's An Answer unto St. Thomas More's Dialogue, More's Supplication of Souls, which answered Simon Fisher's Supplication for the Beggars, and More's The Confutation of Tyndale's Answer. The first of these dialogues was written in 1528, the second followed a year later, and the last, written in two parts, appeared in 1532-1533. They all share More's concern to confute the Lutheran heresies he finds in Tyndale, and by extension, in the works of all the English reformers. The dialogue concerning heresies and the supplication are different in terms of literary artifice from what More does in the confutation. Not only is the confutation enormously larger, but its method virtually abandons any attempt at literary artifice. By literary artifice, I do not mean the argumentative process of debate and refutation which many have observed in the writings of More and Tyndale. My concern is more with the aspects of literary invention. More had used, for example, earlier in the Utopia, in Richard III, that he had learned from in his translations of Lucian, and that he had employed somewhat in the Responsio ad Lutherum. These inventions concern setting, tone, verisimilitude, the use of persona, frame devices, and characterization, which combine in any literary work to make it more delightful, as Horace would say, in order to instruct its readers. Yet the controversial works have had a mixed reception. A.G. Dickens characterized the Tyndale-Moore dispute as dreary verbosity. C.S. Lewis placed Moore's controversial writings in the drab period of 16th century English literature. It is only recently that scholars have subjected Moore's polemical writings to thorough literary analysis in order to understand the nature of his craft. At the turn of the century, George Pratt included a stimulating discussion of early Tudor polemical writings and the rise of English literary prose, yet only recently have his suggestions been more fully developed by Rainer Pinnius in Thomas More's Tudor Polemic. Pinnius' survey of the historical, religious, literary interrelations of More's confrontation with English reformers augments such illuminating historical studies as Bill Clutch's English Earliest Protestants. And most recently, James Lusardi's introduction to the Yale edition of the Confutation has summarized the historical context, but adds little to our understanding of the literary art used by Moore in his dialogues. Moore's involvement in what Tucker Brook has called an acrimonious pamphlet war resulted from the plea of his friend Bishop Cuthbert Tunstall, who wrote in 1528, "Because you, dearest brother, can rival Demosthenes in our vernacular as well as in Latin, and are a frequent and brilliant advocate of the Catholic position, you will never find a better way of spending any leisure hours you can snatch away from your official duties than publishing in English for the common man some books that would help him see through the cunning malice of heretics, and so keep him fortified against these traitorous subverters of the church." Moore, of course, had already had a hand in preparing Henry VIII's Assertio Septem Sacramentorum and the Responsio ad Lutherum, which would justify Tunstall's comparison of Moore to the great Greek orator Demosthenes, who used his skill against the conquering Philip II of Macedon. Moore meets Tunstall's challenge by pouring all his literary energies into this activity. Moore's dialogue with Sir Thomas More Knight, commonly referred to as a dialogue concerning heresies, is the most comprehensive of his polemical writings, and because it is the first of his polemical dialogues, we should examine the attempt he makes at directing his attack in literary attire. The form of this work is unique among English dialogues. The whole purports to be a letter written to a friend reporting a series of conversations Moore had with a messenger sent by the friend to get Moore's opinions on the new Lutheran heresies, and particularly the threat posed by Tyndale's translation of the New Testament and his obedience to the Christian man. The four folks report the conversations held during 3 days, including a gap of about a fortnight. Moore summarizes action that takes some time, for the messenger to read certain books Moore has suggested he read, and Moore narrates the gist of some of the dialogue. The messenger, claiming to be a perfectly devout Catholic, assumes the position of a Lutheran in order to elicit the response of Moore. Though he covers almost all the popular attacks on the church, the messenger proceeds informally, jumping from one point to another, doubling back on himself and sidetracking Moore, much like a real disputant in popular theology might do. The unnamed narrator, Quad I, as Tyndale facetiously calls him, does not attack his adversaries directly, but sets up a straw man in the messenger who is described as having reformist leanings. The artifice of indirection has been used by Moore in his well-known letter to Dorff, and allows him the same kind of sympathy from his audience in 1528 that he drew from Dorff. In his letter to Dorff concerning a dispute about dialectics and theology, Moore began with the discussion of friendship, and indicated that he writes to Dorff out of love and a concern for what he had heard others say about him. This strategy is clever, in that it allows Moore to touch on the serious accusations which threaten to breach common concerns without directly attacking Dorff. This art of indirection in the dialogue concerning heresies is directly related to the veracity of the frame story Moore establishes, and which functions to help distance his rebuttal of reformist doctrines. The frame device was often used by Renaissance authors, but none had done it so uniquely, nor integrated so well as part of their work as Moore had done, for example, in the Utopia. The monologue of Hippolyte in Book 2 of Utopia, you recall, is carefully prepared for by both the preparatory letters exchanged between learned men and in the conversations between Moore, Peter Giles, and Hippolyte, which constitute Book 1. In later, more tranquil moments, we might remember too, Moore again employs an effective frame device in the Dialogue of Comfort, which takes place as the Turks threaten to invade Budapest, which hastens young Vincent's visit to his ailing uncle for advice on how to meet the crisis. And recall, too, the elaborate fiction surrounding Moore's pseudonymous authorship of the Responsio ad Lutherum, and the fictional setting established by the preparatory letters, which explain how William Ross has undertaken to rebut Luther. These fictional letters in the Responsio, however, arouse an expectation never fully realized once the book gets underway, which is not unlike what occurs in the dialogue concerning heresies. The dialogue begins with an account of how the messenger has come to visit to be instructed in Moore's opinions, more narrates the circumstances which have led him to write down the entire conversation, lest the servant not give an accurate report. The verisimilitude established is credible enough to have led one respected scholar to believe that the visit actually happened. Moore is doing the same thing he did in carefully constructing the opening of Utopia. He establishes the veracity of situation and the historicity of event. What contributes to this credibility is portrayal of the messenger, who admits he has some Latin, who finds scripture difficult to understand, yet refuses to use a gloss to elucidate the text. He is described as honest and of a nature nothing tongue-tied. Moore recounts how, quote, he told me merrily that logic he reckoned by babbling, music to serve for fingers, arithmetic meat for merchants, geometry for masons, astronomy good for no man, and as for philosophy, the most vanity of all. Eventually the messenger will lose all sympathy through his own words, a self-parody perhaps, not unlike Hippolyte's unconscious parody for those in on the utopian joke. Another function of the frame device is to establish the character of Moore. The narrative's pose is that of a scholar gentleman to whom people come for advice and counsel. What Aristotle called the ethical appeal, the ethos, in persuasive discourse is developed by Moore at the outset of the dialogue. The narrator reveals that he has decided to publish the dialogue only after the counsel of others more than one. He has some reservations about certain tales and merry words which the messenger mingled with his matter, which he suggests might seem overlight and wanton for the weight and gravity of such an earnest matter. These merry tales function in the dialogue to vary subject matter, relieve monotony, and as has been suggested, to divert the reader's attention from points of view and issue, as well as to lower the messenger in the estimation of the audience. The messenger, not unlike Moore's adversaries, cannot fathom Moore's manner. But he used, I have to say, to look so sadly when you mean merrily, that many times men doubt whether he speak in sport when he mean good earnest. This characteristic of Moore finds expression in Roper's well-known passage about how Moore would step in among the players at Christmas entertainments, and is the general pose which Edward Hall, the contemporary chronicler, characterizes. He says, he was, meaning Moore, he was so much given to mocking, I cannot tell whether I should call him a foolish wise man or a wise foolish man. And I also have antecedents in Moore's early translations of Lucian. Erasmus observed how Moore was used to doing the same as Lucian, that is, mix the serious with the entertaining, speak truth while he laughs, and laugh while he speaks the truth. The underlying irony found in Lucian's satiric dialogues may help to explain the gentle, ironic portrait of the messenger, as well as the gentle mocking from Quad Eye, which runs throughout most of the dialogue. In the third book, when conversation is resumed after a short interval, during which the messenger had visited Cambridge, for example, he explains how many are offended at the burning of Tyndale's New Testament and the treatment of Thomas Dilday. The topicality of these events ensures the messenger's, and I suggest the reader's, interest in the conversation, and they enliven what might become a tedious discussion between interlocutors. Coupled with the realization that Moore does not have any long speeches in the dialogue, the action becomes more dramatic and less static. Moore's method of directly juxtaposing the actual words of his opponents contributes to the dramatic effect by establishing indirectly dialogue mankey. What is clear is that in the dialogue concerning heresies, Moore the artist has not yet been swallowed up by Moore the controversialist. He is still the artist and the man of letters. The artist in Moore was never understood by his adversaries, particularly Tyndale, who emphasizes at the opening of his Supper of the Lord and answer to Thomas Moore, how, to quote the marginal glosses, Moore is a great set of false and unwritten verities. Moore is a common jester and a scoffer, or, worst of all, Moore was a subtle poet. Tyndale disparages Moore for being a poet, a feigner of truth, one who simulates reality. What may not Moore say, he says, by authority of his poetry? In one place, Tyndale wonders, if he will believe whatsoever Moore can feign without the scriptures, then can this poet feign to another church than Christ? And he accuses Moore of having so long used figures of poetry that, quote, his errors be so subtly couched that no man can aspire to. More embodies the sin of covetousness, which Tyndale says, blinded the eyes of that leering fox more and more, and hardened his poetry, babbling with confidence of his painted poetry, babbling eloquence, and juggling arguments of subtle sophistry, grounded on his unwritten verities, as true and as authentic as his story, Utopia. This charge was partially answered by Moore in his apology. He says, for though Tyndale is first in their writings call me a poet, it is but of their own courtesy, undeserved of my part. For I can neither so much poetry, nor so much rhetoric neither, as to find good names for evil things. Moore is writing in 1533 in the apology, in a somewhat more bitter mood than the Moore we know from the Utopia, or even from the Dialogue Concerning Heresies. But it's just the point that his adversaries did not think for poet a negative epithet. A younger Moore may have welcomed the title. Moore's Supplication of Souls was written in answer to Simon Fish's incendiary anti-clerical pamphlet, The Supplication for the Beggars. Fish's supplication is to the King of England. The beggars complain that they are starving because clerics have so monopolized begging that they own a third of the kingdom. A minor point, but one Moore latches onto, is that purgatory is a money-making racket invented by the clergy. Moore's reply is addressed to all good Christian people, from their late acquaintances, kindred spouses, companions, playfellows, and friends, now poor prisoners to sell these souls in purgatory. To these souls who would be abandoned to their fate if Fish's counsels were carried out, Moore claims that Fish's anti-clericalism is motivated by heresy under, quote, pretext of reformation. Fish shall essay to make new divisions of every man's land and substance. The dialogue is in two parts. In the first part, the souls of purgatory discuss such topics as transfer of property to the church, currency values, laws against heretics. There is much statistical information which is given in an effort to confute Fish's and perhaps to parody his own use of statistics. The second part concerns purgatory and cites spiritual proofs and patristic authority for the existence of purgatory. It is clear that Moore takes his cue from Fish in duplicating the idea of a supplication, replacing the beggars with the souls in purgatory. The soul functions as a persona, much like the quad-eye narrator in the Dialogue Concerning Heresies. Moore's work, however, is longer than Fish's and probably loses in effectiveness in proportion to its length. However, we should remember that Moore is replying to a very popular pamphlet, which Anne Boleyn reportedly gave Henry VIII, who loved it, and its author. Thus, although the dialogue purports to address the simple folk, this seems to be a more regal reader in mind. Toward the end of the first part, for example, we are asked to recall the peasants' revolt, which set, quote, set first upon spiritual prelates, but shortly thereupon they so stretched unto the temporal princes. This may also explain why there is less humor than one might expect, and an absence of theological exposition. The souls speak authoritatively about purgatory because they know it intimately, and their impartiality is revealed, for example, in their concern for Fish's soul. They claim their situation is even worse than earthly beggars because their needs are greater. They even, at one point, claim that they can't even find themselves a cloak. The setting of the supplication recalls, of course, Lucian's Dialogues of the Dead. Yet Moore's work lacks any of the pithy liotes or dramatic situation found in Lucian. There's a hint of this, perhaps, in one of the more memorable fictions of the supplication in the lineup of Catholics against Protestants, which matches patristic fathers against reformers. Augustine against Luther, and Ambrose against Huskin. For example, Huskin being a name for Patty. And the opposite sect is involved here too. We have, for example, St. Anastas against Friar Luther's wife, St. Hildegard's against Friar Huskin's wife. A rather interesting lineup. Moore has a chance here to make this dialogue more interesting from a literary perspective by exploring the setting and the situation. This goes unrealized, however, perhaps due to the haste of composition or its intended reader in Henry VIII. Or it could be the growing seriousness which Moore recognizes in the reformist attacks. It has been suggested, for example, that the lack of humor in Moore's supplication should be seen as evidence of his perception of the threat posed by Fish, whom he calls the senseless clown, whom he also links very closely with Luther and Tyndale. The growth of the Lutheran forces in England and their development on the continent is perhaps best described by a Catholic apologist, William Barlow, who wrote a dialogue describing the original ground of these Lutheran factions, 1531. This relatively neglected dialogue is notable for its moderation. The point of view is Catholicism tempered by common sense. It skillfully discusses the Reformation in Europe and indicates the delicate state of affairs in England. The opposition of Innocence and the interlocutor Nicholas and experience in the character of William creates an ironic structure that is effective without seeming to be biased. William, who had just returned from Germany, reports on the behavior of the Lutherans to his friend Nicholas and observes that even though the Lutherans have the Bible in German, their behavior is no whit the better. Nicholas, a Lutheran sympathizer, is surprised to learn that William has been converted to Catholicism. The Lutherans, explained William, are the disciples of Antichrist, and at Nicholas's request that he may set many men's hearts at rest in this troublous season, he outlines the historical facts of Luther's revolt. The account is vigorous, slanted, and sometimes effectively satirical, though nearly outrageously so. William emphasizes the contentions of various sects and focuses on the Zwinglians, the Lutherans, and the Anabaptists. William details his revulsion of the practice of the Lutherans, who have destroyed churches and monasteries, and he also mentions how many of the leaders are immoral. Luther incited the peasants' revolt, and then, he says, betrayed them. Nicholas attacks the luxurious living of the friars, which William does not object to, but points out how the Lutherans are no better. Nicholas sees the English clergy abusing their calling, and if the Lutherans are worse, the only solution seems to be a general reformation made by the Pope and the Christian princes. William has some fears about the Pope, but acknowledges that reform is one way to stop the spread of Lutheranism. But if he will put away all Lutherans and all such open heresies, we must first put away many other sins which have brought these heresies in, he says. Nicholas asks how men can know God when the New Testament in English is forbidden. William will not admit that as the times are now, even an amended version of Tyndale's translation should be published. The people had the word of God preached and expounded to them with the glosses of the doctors because the unlearned cannot interpret scripture properly. Those who have the scriptures in their own tongues have no better morals than those who don't. If the people ask the true priest, God will grant them. But Nicholas is not satisfied that the scriptures should not be translated, and he promises to defend Tyndale some other time. They agree to meet again, the dialogue ends. Paul's dialogue might serve as a final voice of moderation. Tyndale mistakenly accused Moore of being the real author of Paul's work, probably because it was published by Moore's nephew, William Rastell, and appeared at the same time as the second edition of Moore's dialogue concerning heresies. It could be true that Tyndale recognized in the tone and style of the work the hand of the Moore he had studied and refuted. A different style and a different Moore is revealed, however, in the confutation of Tyndale's answer. Moore's confutation fails to display the literary artifice Moore attempted in his earlier dialogues. Its method is the harsh manner of the virulent polemicist. The whole confutation is some 5 times longer than Tyndale's answer and limits his attack to the first fourth of Tyndale's reply. The method used is to quote Tyndale briefly and then give an exhaustive commentary. Perhaps Moore hoped to crush his opponent and his doctrines once and for all by the fullness and ponderosity of his own arguments. What is missing in the confutation is the artifice Moore used effectively earlier. He does include many a merry tale, which might, as Lusardi suggests in his edition of the confutation, appeal to the simple reader, but these anecdotes do not follow any pattern or give rise to any elements which might help distance or unify the whole. Moore even employs the favorite polemical weapon of Tyndale, the use of sarcasm. One example will have to suffice. Moore responds to Tyndale's criticism of his darling Erasmus by exaggerating the use of the adjective and subjecting Tyndale's response to sarcastic ridicule. Now, quote, I have not contended with Erasmus, my darling, because I found no such malicious intent with Erasmus, my darling, as I find with Tyndale. For had I found with Erasmus, my darling, the shrewd intent and purpose that I find with Tyndale, Erasmus, my darling, should be no more, my darling. But I find in Erasmus, my darling, that he detested and aborted the errors and heresies that Tyndale teaches, and therefore Erasmus, my darling, shall be my dear darling still. And the computation seems to revel in epithets such as calling Tyndale a bottle full of lies and incredible acrimonious scandals about Luther's marriage and sex life, which, while not totally new to more political writing, certainly are excessive and more abusive than he has used before. We might conclude with James Maudsley in his biography of Tyndale, that the computation is, as he says, eloquent proof of the devastating effects of controversial zeal on Moore's mind and style. It seems clear that Moore is concerned with artifice and style, which contribute to eloquence and learning, has been replaced in the computation with another form of rhetoric, which concerns the argumentative, the diatribe, and the wish not to educate and reform, but to refute and demolish. The artist Moore will revive his earlier concerns and techniques in the Dialogue of Comfort, but here, in 1533, he clearly has degenerated the literary form of the dialogue to write polemical harangue. We are somewhat prepared for this drab work, to play with C.S. Lewis's terms, if we see in the Dialogue concerning heresies and the supplication of souls a dim golden glimmer. In the heat of dispute, the need to defeat supplants the more delightful persuasions of art. David Knowles' observation on the League of War perhaps captures the spirit we've observed here in this form, when Knowles suggests a picture of Moore as, quote, a man who has moved away from and beyond all his friends, who has chosen to abandon all his interests rather than to compromise with what he sees as evil, who has known the ultimate solitude of misunderstanding from those he loved most. That is not the same man as the friend of Erasmus and the center of Holbein's family groups. We might conclude that the polemical dialogues also reveal a man who has moved away from literary art as a persuasive medium and abandoned the fruits of his delightful fictions to combat the enemy, not with art, but with his own harsh polemical tools. Thank you.
Professor McLean's comment about Moore's drab work seems a fitting introduction to my own study, part of which Edmund Spencer in the Book of Common Prayer, I'll refer to at the start and get it out of the way. Those of you who have looked recently at the Book of Common Prayer know that to say anything about it in 20 minutes is extremely difficult, and those of you who have read The Faery Queen, or say nothing of the rest of Spencer, know that in 20 minutes it's next to impossible to say anything about. But I'll try to combine them and make a few comments on this particular topic. Bear with me. Among various Lisbon and religious groups, Cranmer's masterpiece, The Book of Common Prayer, received mixed reactions. At various times the populace applauded, and in other instances they were appalled. Taken as some as doctrine, was damned by others as popish propaganda. However, no matter which side of the many arguments were taken, the fact remains that everyone read the book. In penny school, the primer exercises and memorization were taken mainly from the Common Prayer Book and the Bible, and young students also seem to have been questioned on the 39 articles. Whether high church or low, Puritan or Calvinist, Elizabethans unavoidably found the prayer book a part of their lives. Either in an affirmative way, or as the object of liturgical and theological disagreement, references and allusions to the prayer book and to its accompanying controversies fill the pages of late Tudor writings. Hooker's monumental laws hardly needs mention in the non-fiction category. The Martin Marprelate papers, reflecting extreme Presbyterian proposals in highly literate prose, are couched in some of the best Tudor, and especially Puritan, satire available. And in fiction, Edmund Spenser stands out not only as a literary representative of the way of media, but exhibits in his writings the wide variety of means available for incorporating or assuming the Book of Common Prayer into other literary forms. No one who has given Spenser's works even the most cursory or superficial of readings could question the importance of Christian doctrine and Christian motifs in those writings. No one versed in the Bible could fail to note the frequent and bountiful employment of biblical language and imagery. And those readers aware of Elizabethan religious controversies have little difficulty in locating passages indicating Spenser's pros and cons concerning, and no pun intended, the burning issues of episcopacy, liturgics, and theology. Yet Spenser's utilization of the prayer book, for the most part, has escaped the eyes and the ears of most critics. His subtle yet not infrequent allusions to its issues, to its readings, and its calendars have been assimilated so subtly and so carefully and thoroughly that their union with Spenser's own language and forms produced an almost perfect and indivisible marriage of the two. Determining the prayer book references in Spenser's works is no easy task, partly because of the splendid amalgamation of the former work into the poems, and particularly because of the allegorical method that Spenser so often employed. The allusions are especially difficult to discern, however, because the distinctions between the prayer book terminology and that of the Bible are usually so fine as to cause readers to assume biblical, not prayer book, sources. Yet in both subject matter and in forms, Cranmer's language and patterns found their way into Spenser's verse. At times, the allusions appear in subject matter, usually in the sense of references to contemporary issues concerning episcopacy or vestments, on which the prayer book, of course, has some very definite things to say. And at times, the allusions appear in particular wordings, often taken directly from the various liturgies and worked into the lines of Spenser's own verse. And in the more sophisticated instances, the allusions actually give form to Spenser's works, a process by which the poet utilized the structures of various rites, various rituals, and calendars in designing his own poems. We will treat some of these incorporations in just that order, as they appear in subject matter and in terminology, and then in forms. Spenser's taking issue with the subject matter referred to in the Book of Common Prayer first appears in his famous The Shepherd's Calendar, published in 1579. The poem's 12 eclogues, corresponding to the 12 months of the year, permit Spenser to voice a number of opinions through his various pastoral characters. In the February eclogue, for example, the old shepherd Fennet relates the tale of the oak and the briar, in which the briar, replete with, quote, colors meet to clothe the maiden queen, certainly represents Elizabeth and the Anglican position, and the oak, often crossed with priest's crew and often hallowed with holy water dew, unquestionably signifies Roman Catholicism in its most favorable light. The May eclogue concerns two shepherds, Piers and Palinode. The gloss which accompanies the poem, by E.K., informs us that two forms of pastors or ministers, or the Protestant and the Catholic, are intended by these two shepherds. The July eclogue, dialogue, contains yet another religious debate, this time between Tomalin, who is a lowland shepherd, who attacks the worldliness and pride of ambitious pastors, and who probably represents Christian humility, and Morel, a hill shepherd, who stands for all that Tomalin inveighs against. Needless to say, Tomalin wins this Mantuanist argument and makes a strong plea for church reform. The September eclogue, in turn, concerns Diggin Davy, quote, devised to be a shepherd that, in hope of more gain, drove his sheep into a far country, the abuses whereof, and loose living with popish prelates, by occasion of Hobnall's demand, he discourseth at large. Unquote. Such contemporary commentary, this is by E.K., leaves little to our imaginations as to how the Elizabethans would interpret the work. But what of these eclogues and the Book of Common Prayer? In his first among the comments about popish prelates, worldly pastors, and aspiring briars are references to items directly taken up by and in the prayer book. Opposing the elaborate ritual, vestments, and ornaments of Edward's first and of Elizabeth's prayer books, as well as much common practice in the churches, the youthful Spenser over and again calls for a return to the simplicity of earlier religious forms and a time when shepherds, not having, not feared they, to forego. The clergy's fine clothes, for example, get special attention by Tamlin, who is that lowman shepherd. But now, thanks be God, therefore, the world is well amend. Their weeds been not so nighly wore, such simplest not them shend. They've been clad in purple and pall, so hath their God been blessed, and reigned and ruling over all, and were it, as they list. He girt with belts of glittering gold, mock they good shepherds been. Their pan, their sheep, to them has sold. The same arguments appear in another of Shepherd's early works called Mother Hubbard's Tale, a work probably written just a short time after the calendar. From the mouth of an ignorant, an arrogant, and a silly priest comes praise of the present situation as he would meet the situation in the churches. The satire and the irony are obvious as, one after another, the new ways of religion are compared to the old. Priests, we are told, used duly every day their service and their holy things to say, at morn and even, besides their anthems sweet. Now all those needless works are laid away. Now once a week, upon the Sabbath day, it is enough to do our small devotion. Nor are we tied to fast, but when we list, nor to wear garments base of woolen twist, but with the finest silks us to array, that before God we may appear more gay. With glee the speaker goes on, to the priest, to note that priests may now marry. Besides we may have, lying by our sides, our lovely lasses, or bright shining brides. We be not tied to willful chastity, but have the gospel of free liberty. Spencer's obvious preference for simpler clothes, old ceremonies, and a celibate clergy does not single him out as either a Puritan or an Anglican, but all are matters which treat in one way or another the problems of episcopacy and ceremony which appear in the prayer book. There's no angry protest. Instead, the very worst of a thoroughly unchristian attitude toward religion is presented positively through the mouth of one of its very own priests. Spencer includes other debatable prayer book matters in his works too. The subject matter references are more prominent in the Faerie Queene than anywhere else, perhaps because of its own subject, and certainly because of its length. The use of the sign of the cross, for example, appears at the very start of the epic in the description of the knight, Red Cross. But on his breast a bloody cross he bore, the dear remembrance of his dying Lord, for whose sweet sake that glorious badge he wore, and dead as living ever him adored. Upon his shield the life was also scored, for sovereign hope which in his help he had. Red Cross's two crosses function exactly as the sign of the cross marked by the priest in the prayer book rite of baptism. Receive the sign of the Holy Cross both in thy forehead and in thy breast, in token that thou shalt not be ashamed to confess thy faith in Christ crucified, and manfully to fight under his banner against sin, the world, and the devil, and to continue his faithful soldier and servant unto thy life's end. Altars, too, receive their share of attention in the Anglican and Puritan arguments. Spencer treats both altars and tables, but the former, that is, altars, appear far more frequently than the latter. And when he writes of his own marriage in the Epithalamion, it's at the high altar, not at a table. Auricular confession is included as well. Spencer writes of Red Cross in the House of Holiness in Book 1, Canto 10, confessing to the old man named Patience, who has come to heal the body and soul sick knight. Holy Communion and all the problems of transubstantiation, consubstantiation, and symbols find mention in the Faerie Queene, as does baptism, its powers, necessity, and the means of administering. This, however, prohibits treating these items in any detail. Suffice it to say that the allusions to these and to other prayer book matters are frequent, although the problem, again, is in distinguishing prayer book allusions and subject matter from biblical subject matter and allusions. Nowhere does the poet include any sustained reference to the Book of Common Prayer, and nowhere are the allusions direct. In fact, his best incorporations are so subtle that, for the most part, they have been overlooked by readers for hundreds of years. I refer specifically to Spencer's use of the prayer book as structure and as form, as opposed to his employment of the content and thematic references just sketched. Literary information of the prayer book is only a relatively recent topic of pursuit among Spencer scholars. With Spencer's works, the study restricts itself to, almost exclusively, to the 89 sonnets which comprise his sonnet cycle called the Amoretti. Modern studies of the sonnets indicate that far from being a seemingly disorganized array of 14 liners praising a lady, the Amoretti contains some unusual structural patterning. The results of the last several years of Amoretti scholarship show conclusively that the sequence includes an astonishing blend of prayer book calendars, lessons, prayers, psalms, etc., and that the courtship described in the poems, to use the words of the prayer book marriage service, signifies and represents the spiritual marriage and unity between Christ and his church, as well as the courtship of the poet Spencer and his bride-to-be Elizabeth Boyle. Spencer accomplishes this double-telling while describing the progress, as I mentioned, of his own courtship subsequent to their marriage in June of 1594 on St. Barnabas' Day. In brief, the 89 sonnets divide into three groups of 21, 46, and 21 poems. The middle group begins with sonnet 22, and the group is immediately followed, the whole group, by sonnet 68, two sonnets which contain particular references to periods of the church year. The first of these, sonnet 22, begins, "This holy season, fit to fast and pray, men to devotion ought to be inclined. Therefore I likewise on so holy day for my sweet saint some service fit will find." Thus the poet describes his own Ash Wednesday, the start of his own penitential season before being accepted by his lady. This proceeds then for approximately 46 sonnets in which we get the typical Petrarchan moaning and groaning and sighing and dying, you know, as he's waiting to be accepted by the lady. References then in sonnet 68 are even more obviously religious. "Most glorious Lord of life, that on this day did make thy triumph over death and sin, and having harrowed hell, didst bring away captivity thence captive us to win." This Easter sonnet celebrates not only Christ's resurrection, but marks the turning point in the whole sonnet sequence. After this poem, the lover's woes, for the most part, vanish, as the lady accepts him as her groom-to-be. One notes, too, that counting from the Ash Wednesday sonnet, 22, to the Easter sonnet, that there are 46 sonnets in between, comprising the middle segment of this sonnet cycle, exactly the number of fast and feast days given by the calendar for the period of Lent. Using the Easter Sunday example of dating the poems, we may give corresponding days to each and to all of the other sequences of the poems and the rest of the sequence. Most notable among the poems, for our purposes, are the Sunday sonnets. Like the Sundays during Lent, they break the seriousness of the weekdays and change the general spirit of this holy season, which is to say that every seventh sonnet in the sequence, again following the liturgical pattern, changes the whole tempo and the tone of what he's talking about in the middle section of the sequence. To suggest the special quality of these Sunday sonnets, Spencer uses them as narrative breaks in his poetic cycle. Each seventh sonnet of the middle sequence changes the subject from the lover's woes and torments to something like, for example, an address to a friend, a catalog of flowers, sometimes merely a jubilant praise of his own beloved. Furthermore, Spencer incorporates into most of these special sonnet days material from the respective prayer book readings for each day. Thus, sonnet 26, which marks the first Sunday in Lent, records a series of attractions and reactions, objects which are appealing, but which also demand caution when approaching them, in much the same way that the collect for this day, which is 2 Corinthians 6, describes the temptations and the trials of St. Paul, his attractions to various things and the temptations to go towards some things, the possibility of bad things happening to him if he does approach these objects. The couplet ending the sonnet, "Why then should I account of little pain that endless pleasure shall unto me gain," might further be viewed as the poet's adaptation of the temporary little pain of the Lenten fast and the endless pleasure of heaven, the final reward. Sonnet 61, which represents the sixth Sunday in Lent, may serve as one other example. Almost every line of the poem contains some indication that Spencer intends a parallel between the lady and Christ, who on this Palm Sunday made his entry into Jerusalem. The lady is said to be divinely wrought and heavenly born. She is likened to the Christ of Philippians 2, the epistle for this day, from which I quote, "When he was in the shape of God, he thought it no robbery to be equal with God. Nevertheless, he made himself of no reputation, taking on him the shape of a servant, and became like unto men. And because he, like the lady in the sequence, who in the sonnet's words, ought rather worship thee, God hath also exalted him on high, and given him a name which is above all names. Likewise, while the lady humbles herself, the poet, who feels his own unworthiness, exalts her, noting that such heavenly forms ought rather worshipped be than there be loved by men of low degree. The same procedure, with only one exception in the entire sequence, may be used for all the Sundays in the Lenten sequence, as well as the three Sundays preceding Lent, and the Feast of St. Paul, which is the 25th of January, here indicated by Sonnet 3, the days of Holy Week, Sonnets 62 and 67, and the three Sundays after Easter. Celebrating Spenser's courtship, the Amoretti sequence was published along with the more famous Epithalamion, which celebrates his marriage. As one might expect, given the structuring of the sonnet sequence, the marriage hymn also has its prayer book parallels. For the overall structure of the poem, Spenser chose larger patterns, cosmic ones, well described by Professor A. Kent Hyatt in his book Short Time's Endless Monument. But the stanzas describing the marriage itself contain bountiful allusions to the wedding service, the form and the content of which are described in the solemnization of matrimony in the Book of Common Prayer. The prayer book service begins with two rubrics concerning the publishing of bans, neither of which apply here because such announcements always are made before the wedding, and a third rubric which states that at the day appointed, the persons to be married shall come into the body of the church with their friends and neighbors. The two stanzas of the poem which treat of the marriage ceremony, this is comprised of lines 204 to lines up through line 242, these are stanzas 12 and 13 in the poem, contain the poet groom's command to open the temple gates unto my love, open them wide that she may enter in. Members of the congregation are invited, just as they are the friends and the neighbors needed for as witnesses. And from this point on, Spenser, following the example of Catullus and Catullus's Epithalamion, makes his hymn keep time with the ceremonial of the wedding day. The Book of Common Prayer states that the marriage is to be enterprised reverently, discreetly, advisedly, soberly, and in the fear of God. Spenser's bride, with trembling steps and humble reverence, cometh in before the Almighty's view. The poet directs the accompanying young virgins to learn obedience of such approaches, so that they may act accordingly when so ye come into these holy places. The next lines describe the progress inside the church. This is the groom speaking now. Bring her up to the high altar that she may the sacred ceremonies there partake, the which do endless matrimony make, and let the roaring organs loudly play the praises of the Lord in lively notes, the whiles with hollow throats the choristers the joyous anthem sing, that all the woods may answer and their echo ring. The sacred ceremonies referred to in these lines surely refer to the solemnization itself. It's interesting to note the term later becomes sacred rites in line 393 of the poem, the two words being found together in the title page of the Book of Common Prayer, where they are listed as the rites and the ceremonies of the church. It is a holy priest, not a minister or pastor, but a holy priest who performs the service before the altar. He, quote, blesseth her with his two happy hands, indicating the sign of the cross noted in the prayer book blessing of the marriage. Two in the prayer book, the last act of the couple before the priest announces them married is the joining of hands. It is the same act which, in the poem, precedes the comment that now all is done. The groom says, why bless ye, love, to give to me your hand, the pledge of all our band. The ceremony completed, the bride and groom eventually find themselves alone. Once more, the poet groom refers to the day's ceremonies and to their import. In Spenser's poem, Great Juno, the goddess of wedlock, is invoked to solemnize these sacred rites. The Book of Common Prayer naturally invokes God to do the same thing, both in the initial address of the congregation and also in the prayer, O merciful Lord, by whose gracious gifts mankind is increased, we beseech thee assist with thy blessing these two persons, that they may be fruitful in procreation of children. Spenser's poet hopes the lovers will bring forth the fruitful progeny, and that they may raise a large posterity. The Gospel for St. Barnabas' day, St. John 15, 12 through 17, also reminds the apostles that they too have been ordained to go and bring forth fruit. And the fruitfulness of which the poet writes is also mentioned in the wedding psalm, Psalm 128. Finally, the priest's benediction on the couple reads, in part, "Pour upon you the richest of his grace, sanctify and bless you." Among the last words of the bridegroom, and only a few lines from the end of the poem, are the following words, "Pour out your blessing on us plenteously, and happy influence upon us reign." It's a possible reference to the manifold gifts of the Spirit mentioned in the Collect for St. Barnabas' day, but a definite verbatim use of pouring out from the prayer book used in the poem. The subject, indeed, of the St. Barnabas Day service is gifts and their use, and it is with a reference to such that the Epithalamion ends. Song made in lieu of many ornaments, that is, gifts, made in lieu of many ornaments with which my love should duly have been decked. Spence's use of the Book of Common Prayer in tonal, thematic, verbal, and formalistic adaptations indicates both its familiarity with and its reliance on this most significant book of Anglican rite and ritual. Various poetic statements indicate that he was not always in complete accord with the prayer book, or with some of the settlements it indicated, nor with the practices that the church adopted in attempting to follow it. But that the prayer book, with its magnificent incorporation of masses and services and its splendid prose and finely worded statements of faith and practice, was not carefully and studiously attended to by the poet Spencer, man and thinker, cannot be disputed. Thank you.